All right. Well, when last we left Abraham, he and Sarah had just had a child, and as you can imagine, if polygamous relationships are difficult, and that's what we were just talking about, polygamous relationships that have yielded a child on each side are just about impossible. If there was a rivalry before between Sarah and Hagar, when Hagar had a child and Sarah didn't, now there's going to be a particularly acute rivalry, because it's not only going to be between the women, but as you can imagine, it's going to be between the children. Yishmael has children, like adults, are always looking for the upper hand. Yishmael has the upper hand in that he's much older. Isaac has the upper hand in that it's clear that his mother is of higher status than Yishmael's mother. Now, I suppose it's possible in some ideal world that Isaac and Yishmael would get along, but you have to assume from the beginning, even though it doesn't say that Isaac and Yishmael don't get along quite that way, that it says on in verse 8, chapter 21, verse 8, and this is really what I want to spend a good bit of the time today talking about. It says, the child grew up and was weaned, and Abraham held a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. Sarah saw the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Isaac playing. Abraham playing, okay? Mitzachek. Mitzachek is the same word as Yitzchak. Now, the little trip that I'm going to take us on started when I was a kid, and I used the Silverman High Holiday Prayer Book, which we still use, although I hope for not very longer in the congregation, because the rabbinical assembly is coming out in the next year or two with a new High Holiday Prayer Book, which is wonderful in every way except for all the bar mitzvah kids that we've been giving the old High Holiday Prayer Book to for so many years. But the old Silverman has a note at the bottom, okay? Remember, you read this on Rosh Hashanah. So the old Silverman has a note at the bottom. What does it mean, playing? It means that Yishmael would shoot arrows at passersby and laugh when he saw them wounded. And I used to think, that is the most ridiculous thing. I mean, the rabbis really have it in for poor Yishmael. Where did they come up with, he shot arrows at passersby and laughed when he saw them wounded? I once threw crab apples at cars when I was a kid, but that was bad enough. That's actually true. And my friend and I did that, and we hit the car of an off-duty policeman who made us wash. He was very good, actually. He came out, he said, were you doing that? And I was about to deny it. My friend's hands were full of apples. He had two like and he made us wash his car and told us not to do it again. He was, I had these visions of being taken downtown, you know. This is 10 years old. I'm not talking copper. What?
This is your atonement.
This is my atonement, exactly, for that. Okay, so, but the rabbis never make anything up out of whole cloth. And usually, when you can't figure out a rabbinic phrase, it's because you haven't found the garuri, the trigger. You don't know what's in their minds. Remember that these are people who carried this book in their heads with the same familiarity that we carry the names of our children. I mean, it was completely familiar to them, and no word came up that they didn't think automatically of 100 different associations. So if you want to know why the rabbis interpret a word the way they do, one of the first ways, there are lots of ways of going about it, but one of the first ways is to go about it through this. This is a biblical concordance. A concordance lists every instance of the word in the Bible so that you can know when else the word is used. And if you want to know why the rabbis interpret a word the way they do, the first place to look is the other instances in the Bible of the word's usage. So, years later, I finally turned to the concordance, and I found, I'm not going to go through, there are many examples, obviously, of lisachek, which, and the sin and the tzadi are interchangeable. It can be lisachek or litzachek. Both of them are used interchangeably in lots and lots of words, including this. Let's just look, though, at a couple of examples of the way in which the Torah uses this word. I'm going to need the whole Tanakh. I will read you some of the examples. You don't have to flip with me through all of them, except already we can find out from one good example that it's not always a positive word. If you listen to, if you want me to, I'll give you the verses, but otherwise I'll just read you the section so we don't have to all keep flipping. In the book of Exodus, in chapter 32, verse 6, you read as follows. This he took from them and cast in a mold and made it into a molten calf, and they exclaimed, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." And when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it and said, "Tomorrow shall be a festival for the Lord." Early next day, the people offered up burnt offerings and brought sacrifices of well-being. They sat down to eat and drink, and they rose, litzachek. So first of all, the dancing around the golden calf is called tzchok. In other words, litzachek is associated with idolatry, as well as with Isaac's name, which you understand because laughter and mockery can go both ways. Remember, Sarah said, "God is making a tzchok of me. He's making a mockery of me to say that I would have a child." So already there's an ambiguity, and when you read that Yishmael is litzacheking, it's not necessarily a good kind of litzacheking. It might be a bad kind of litzacheking. Back in Genesis, and this is a really interesting use of the same word, and we will come to this later when we actually study it, but since we're looking at the word, when Potiphar's wife is trying to seduce Joseph, okay? Remember that? And then he says, "No, I won't sleep with you." She frames him. She says, "This guy came, and what did he come to do?" Verse 14, "V'tikra lan anshei beito," she called the people of her house and said, "Look, he has brought this man with us, this Hebrew servant, litzachek banu." So there's also a sexual connotation, an illicit sexual connotation, as well as an idolatrous connotation. Then you have a really interesting instance. I'm saving the relevant one for last, but this is a really interesting instance, this one involving Isaac. And every instance involving Isaac you have to pay attention to, especially because, of course, that's his name. Remember that twice now we've seen Abraham pass Sarah off as his sister. Like father, like son. Isaac does the same thing, right? He passes Rebecca off as his sister when he's in Gerar and with the Philistines. And then it says, when some time had passed, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out the window and saw Isaac mitzachek with Rivka ishto, with Rivka his wife. In other words, something, in the way the Hebrew reads, v'hine yitzchak mitzachek, and Isaac was Isaacing, right? Which is, again, obviously sexual, because then the king says, "I thought she was your sister, and look what you're doing with her. Why did you fool me? She's obviously not your sister." So the word yitzchak and litzachek already clearly has a very ambiguous meaning. It can mean laughter, it can mean mockery, it can mean idolatry. But we have not yet gotten to shooting arrows and passersby, right? Although we know from later on that Yishmael is a bowman, that he makes his living by hunting and by shooting a bow. So how do we get to shooting arrows and passersby? For here, you've got to go to 2 Samuel 2:16, and you will read as follows. Here, David and Yoav, Yoav being David's general and Avner being Saul's general, meet, and they each have a small army. Okay, and at the time, if you remember, Saul is the king of Israel. David is the young upstart. They're fighting a sort of covert battle that becomes overt. And that means that Yoav and Avner, who are their lieutenants, are also fighting a battle with each other. And as often happens, I mean, if you go to Israel, you see, you know, the battle of the two kingdoms is like the battle between Gold Hall and Barad Hall. They're just that close and just that small, right? I mean, we're not talking about huge areas. So Avner and Yoav run into each other with their troops. Now, Avner and Yoav don't want to fight because they're lieutenants. They're too important to kill each other. Although that happens later, by the way, when things finally deteriorate, Yoav does kill Avner. But what happens actually is that once David becomes king, he wants Avner on his side. So he basically recruits him to become his lieutenant. Well, Yoav doesn't like that one bit, so he sets Avner up and kills him. All in the Bible. Anyway, so once Avner, son of Ner, and the sons of Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, marched out from Machanaim to Gibeon. This is after Saul, Avner takes the leadership of Saul's son, Ish-bosheth. And Yoav, son of Zeruiah, and the soldiers of David also came out. They confronted one another at the pool of Gibeon. One group sat on one side of the pool, and the other group sat on the other side of the pool. Avner said to Yoav, Yakumu, let us rise. Yakumu Nahanarim, let us raise the youngsters, or the soldiers, basically. V'yishaku lifanenu, and they should make sport before us. They should litzachek before us. Now, what do you think they're going to do? This is what they're going to do. They came forward and were counted off, 12 for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, 12 Davidic soldiers. Each one grasped his opponent's head and thrust his dagger into his opponent's side, and they fell together. That's litzachek too. Wow. Now, the reason that this is important is we use words all the time that have lots and lots and lots and lots of meanings, but because we're native speakers, and because we know the context, we understand what the word means. And the only time you really think about it is when your child is learning English. And then you say, well, I know it says this, but when you use this word in this context, it doesn't really mean that, right? An example doesn't come to mind in a minute, but I'm sure if you think about it for a second, you'll think of examples of words that have very different meanings in very different contexts, okay? What's that? Right, cool. Could be a perfect example. Or for that matter, cleave, which has opposite meanings. Sometimes cleave means to stick to something, and yet when you cleave something, you split it in half. Okay? So if you didn't know and you didn't have context and you had the word cleave in the Bible, you would assume one or the other, but you would never know that it could mean both. And every time you saw cleave, you would think it meant one. So here, litzachek has lots and lots of different meanings. And since they don't define what Yishmael was doing, okay? And immediately after Yishmael does it, Sara kicks him out of the house. And we know that he made his living by shooting arrows. And we have an example that litzachek means to kill someone. And it also means laughter. They don't want to make Ishmael into a murderer, after all, because if he's a murderer, you got to do worse than just kick him out of the house. Very, very sound midrash. It's a very sensible elaboration of this to Ishmael was shooting at people and laughing at them, and therefore had to be kicked out of the house. Okay? So that which seems ridiculous, it's still obviously a woven story for a purpose, but it's not in a vacuum. It's based on the different meanings that litzachek can have, which we would never know if we didn't trace it through the biblical text. Now, there are lots of other examples of litzachek that also exist here. But I closed the wrong book. But I wanted to mention that, and also to mention, now it's probably much easier to do online, but to mention a concordance, which is an invaluable tool to understand what the Bible is talking about, because our only examples of biblical Hebrew are the Bible. So that means there were lots and lots of words that we don't have, and there were lots of ways that words were used that we do have that we don't have, right? I'm sure there were other ways that different words in the Bible were used, but, and then there are words in the Bible that are what are called hapex legomena. That means they're only used once in the whole biblical text, and we can't compare them to any other words. So we don't know what else they might mean. Okay. Yeah, please. Well, words don't work that way. The words don't work the way that I might use the word, I might use the word cleave one way now and one way in 10 years, and yet cleave meant both at both times. The fact that it's used one way the first time doesn't mean that's the basic meaning. It could be used in a tangential way the first time and used in the fundamental way the second time. Right.
What does Isaac then mean?
Laughter.
Laughter.
Right. It said that's how it's defined in the Bible, right? At least at the beginning, because Sarah says all who see me will laugh. But laughter too is a very, you know, you're laughing at me is very different from I had a good laugh over that. So yeah.
I'm thinking how much of Ishmael's behavior is a reflection of the household he was raised in and the parenting he got and the relationship between three parents, basically, that he had. He was reflecting something about them.
It could be. I'm always of two minds about this. There's a great, for those of you who like mystery novels, let me ruin one for you. There is a very, in the annals of people who care about mystery novels, there's a very famous mystery novel called Trent's Last Case, written by E.C. Bentley. And Trent's Last Case is, it's sort of a Sherlock Holmes kind of novel where this brilliant detective solves a mystery and comes to a whole series of brilliant deductions. And the reason it became such a famous novel is he turns out to be completely wrong. And then in the end, he discovers what the real truth is. But this, you can do the same thing with families. That is, looking back, I can tell you, based on my family, why my personality is the way it is. And I can make a very convincing case. But I promise you, if I was completely different, I could do the same thing. And explanatory after the case is very, I mean, we could do it. I'll bet you could write a very good scenario about why Ishmael's violent. He never had good parenting. His mother was second in command at best. I mean, you could make a good case. It could also be, though, that that's how he was. And had he had a different upbringing, he would have been that way. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think it's certainly true that that you wouldn't expect Ishmael to come out of this well-adjusted. I mean, if you think about it, he's kicked out when he's a kid, he's brought back, his mother clearly is unhappy. He has a father, but he doesn't count first with his father. I mean, if you want to make a case for somebody who shouldn't be very happy, Ishmael has a lousy upbringing. And that may be, by the way, why the Bible's treatment of him is very sympathetic. The rabbi's treatment isn't sympathetic. That business about shooting passersby, it's not in the Bible, right? That's in the rabbinic literature. The Bible seems to treat him pretty sympathetically.
When I read this for the first time some years ago, I somehow got past Cain and Abel. It seems to me, I've always had a sense that I can't prove that Genesis is maybe a big code for something else. And the code of sibling rivalry here is so clear. That they are fighting over something.
Why code of sibling rivalry as opposed to just example of sibling rivalry?
Because
other than if you're shilling for Da Vinci, I don't want to hear it. Okay, I just want to say no advertising in the class. It's not.
Because I think there were some issues that the rabbis did not want to say.
Can I interrupt you on a totally different.
Sure.
At the end of May, I'm going to Rome for a week. I've never been to Rome, and I'm really looking forward to it, but I'm so curious to see. I'm going May 21st and May 19th, the movie comes out. And I just can't wait to hear what they have to say. I'm sure they won't like it. In the worst, I mean, they already don't. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, so. I've always had the feeling that this sounds silly as I utter the words, that Freud's footsteps are often.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Footsteps
I don't
know. Are in the story.
Yes. Well, let me put it this way. Freud said himself that the greatest insight into human nature is from the poets and the writers. I think that there's no lasting text of human civilization, whether it be Gilgamesh or the Bible or Homer, that doesn't have tremendous insight into the psychodynamics of human beings, or it wouldn't have lasted. People wouldn't have found themselves in it. And if you don't find yourself in it, it tends not to last. So I think that that's true. In the same way that people do in art, and later on in music, because we don't really have ancient music the same way. But yes, I think especially in Genesis. Genesis is the book where you see much more than any other book. I don't know what we're going to do with the class when we get to Leviticus, but Genesis is the book where you see all the psychodynamics of human, especially family. So. Which is a problem, because it does not portray the family as a smoothly functioning unit, right, to say the least. And by the way, neither does the New Testament. Jesus never gets married. Right? This is what I think it was James Joyce, who said that both Jesus and the Buddha were flawed guides to humanity because neither was married and neither had children. And, you know, there really is a limit to the extent to which, remember that on the Sanhedrin, on the Jewish court, you were not allowed to sit on a capital case unless you had a child, because you don't know what human life is if you don't have a child. So it's an interesting thought. Anyway.
It's kind of tough on the vicar of Rome.
It does. But, I mean, look, there are lots and lots of experiences in life that you cannot transmit to someone else who hasn't had them. I mean, in the famous example that philosophers use, you can't describe the taste of an orange, right? I mean, that's a very simple, basic experience, but you try to tell somebody else who's never had a citrus fruit what an orange tastes like. You can't do it. But of all the experiences of life that are untransmissible that most people have, the most common one is having children, right? The jump from single to married, married to children, they're not commensurate. Right, from single to married is a much smaller jump than it is from married to children. So, yeah, I mean, I would say that there's something that the Pope will never understand about life, even though exceptional people can make exceptional empathetic leaps, but still. Any other? What's that? Yes, well, he's yet to write me to ask when I'm coming, but... But if he does, I'll certainly mention it to him. No, I'm actually going to see other ancient things, not that ancient thing. So it's a historical archaeological tour. All right. So let's go back now to verse 7. Chapter 21, verse 7. Sarah says, "Who would have said, Milel, mi Yimalel?" You know, that's mi Yimalel who wrote the same idea. Mi Milel, who would have sung, really, to Abraham, that Sarah would suckle children, yet I have borne a son in his old age. Now, that's a strange way of constructing this little poem, and that's the most biblical scholars think that it actually has a sort of poetic. I'll read you what Sarna says. The utterance of Sarah has the form of a song. It consists of three short clauses of three words each. The forms of the verbs, as well as the rare stem malel, seem to indicate that the words had their origin in an ancient poem. And malel may be a play on milah, to circumcise, right? Because he's about to be circumcised. He was just circumcised, rather, or was about to be. One second. No, hasn't been yet. Right, yes, in verse 4 is circumcised. So why do you think Sarah says it this way? Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would have suckled children? To him. That's a nice way. I had a slightly more cynical way of thinking about it, I've not had a chance actually to look at the commentators and what they say about it. But remember what happens when God comes to Abraham and says that he's going to have a child. What does Sarah do? And then what happens? God catches her, and she says, I didn't laugh. But in this poem, she takes herself out of it, right? It was actually only, it was only set to Abraham. Who, imagine that someone would have said to Abraham that Sarah would suckle a child, as though it wasn't said to her at all, because her memory of it being said to her is probably slightly painful. You know, God caught you in a lie. That's really not good. What's that? Yeah, well, that's true. And also, it may reflect, by the way, we talk about God saying it, but presumably, this is a matter of gossip for the neighbors, too. You know, that somebody's having a child in, whatever, at 100 years, but in advanced old age, will not go unnoticed in a small community, presumably. This is clearly a topic that, comfortably or not, would be a subject of conversation. And then the last line, what does she say?
He's older.
Yeah, exactly.
Why doesn't she say
that's right. Ever? That's right. Yep. I've borne a son in his old age. Which could be, you know, you could see it again. You could see it two ways. You could see it as though she thinks of him as his son, and she's born the son for him, and that's the self-sacrificing way. Or the other is, you know, she just doesn't think of herself as old, just thinks of Abraham as old. And so I've born a son in his old age, even though I'm a spring chicken. And there is, by the way, a midrash that Sarah didn't only suckle Isaac, but many people. And you can see why. Look at the second line. What does it say in Hebrew? Henika banim Sarah. Banim means children, not child, right? That Sarah was rejuvenated. And there are all sorts of midrashim about what's the nice way to put this? The hyperactivity of her breast milk, basically. But the idea behind this is that, I'm sorry?
How do you suckle without giving birth? In other words, the glands.
Well, she did give birth.
No, but you said she suckled
other children as well as Isaac at the same time. Right, at the same time, yep. Like a wet nurse. And this is part of, remember, the whole idea of making Sarah youthful again, that she gave birth and that she suckled children. There's a sense of rejuvenation about what happened with Sarah in her old age that's part of the miraculous nature of Isaac's birth. Although she says that I've born a son in his old age, she's born the son. Right, she says ki yaladati. She doesn't say because he had a son. So it's still her. And then the child grows up and is weaned, which means clearly that she was responsible for suckling him. And Abraham makes a great feast on the day that Isaac is weaned. And I assume that the feast is made on the day that the child is weaned because that by the time a child is weaned, it's a pretty good chance that they're going to live. That would be my guess. I mean, today we would make a feast, you know, at the Brit Milah because the odds are overwhelming that a child is going to live. But then that was probably just the beginning of the danger. You know, if according to Jewish law, if a child dies before the eighth day, you don't say Kaddish for them. And the reason that you don't, I'm sure, is because it was so common for children to die in childbirth or in the first couple days of life that the loss was different in kind than a child who was a year old. Yeah.
I have a different take. You know, when I read verse 6, Sarah is admitting to all that humiliation, or mm-hmm. God made laughter for me, and then says this about Abraham. And I think, especially about the feast, I think she's very clever that she gives a lot of credit to Abraham to kind of glorify this stage of life and Isaac, so that Abraham ends up having a feast for him and starting to favor Isaac over Ishmael.
Right, I understand. It may be that Sarah is doing this because she wants to make sure that Abraham sees Isaac as the primary kid. And so she emphasizes how wonderful and miraculous it is and that I gave this son to you, all of that. That certainly makes sense because she, you know, I mean, Abraham now has had how many years of attaching himself to Ishmael? And you want to make sure, I mean, this is the... I don't want to tread on dangerous ground here, and since I don't know all your personal lives, I'll just say this without, I have no idea if this applies to anybody here, and if it does, please know that it's not directed to you. But this is the issue of the children of the second wife, right? In our own day, when a man gets remarried and then has children, it's a very, very difficult situation, in particular on the children of the first wife, who cannot help but feel themselves usurped by the new kid. And the second wife cannot help but feel that she wants her husband's loyalty to be to her children and not to the first kids of the life that he lived, which she knows was really no good before she came along and made his life good, right? So there is a natural power struggle here. It's played out slightly differently here because Hagar's a handmaiden and so on, but it's the same power struggle, and Sarah's interest is the same as the second wife's interest, which is to make sure that her child takes priority. And this comes, you know, with inheritance and other things. It's a very, it's tricky, obviously. And Ishmael shows, which is not always the case, and I've actually never thought about it before, but one of the things that determines this dynamic is how attached are the children to the first wife, the children of the first wife. Like, are they close to their mother, in which case it's going to be more difficult to work this out because their mother is the rejected one as the father takes the new wife. And Yishmael's closeness, apparently, to Hagar, right, he leaves twice with her, right? It's not that Yishmael stays home and Hagar leaves. Hagar and Yishmael leave together. So his closeness to Hagar is going to make this arrangement just unworkable. I've never read a commentary, because as I say, the issue's never occurred to me before just now. I've never read a commentary about whether Ishmael had a choice or maybe wanted to stay with Abraham or Isaac, which would make a nice midrash, actually, that he had a choice, but he chose to stay with Hagar. You could make a very beautiful story out of that. And I wouldn't be surprised if in Islamic commentary that midrash exists, I wonder. As I said, I Reuven Firestone, I hope, will be with us next year to talk about it, but when I called his office, he was on sabbatical in Cairo. So, but next year, I'll bring him to tell us about how the Islamic tradition treats this story. Okay, any other questions? Yeah, please.
I happened to have been at a cousin's club last night with Muslim and Jewish women, and we were talking about Muslim girls and Jewish
No, I didn't know.
But her name is not mentioned in the Quran. And Abraham is thought of as the real foreshadowing prophet to Muhammad because he recognized the one God, and that's what's emphasized.
Right.
And there isn't any emphasis of the conflict of the two women.
So is there a mother figure at all?
Yeah, he had a mother. Her name was the mother of Ishmael. And they both came up and they both did it. But they're in a culture, and I assume that Islam grew up in a culture where multiple wives and families
were not uncommon at all.
Not uncommon at all.
No.
And our assumption that it could never work somehow comes from a culture-based rather than because there has been,
there have been a lot of cultures where it has worked for a long time.
Exactly, and that really shows that culture.
Fortunately, if somebody's listening to the tape, they won't know what it is, so I didn't say it. It, of course, is not polygamy. I wasn't talking about that. No, there have been, I mean, obviously, there are cultures where polygamy has flourished for thousands of years. As I said, in the Jewish world, polygamy was only outlawed in Islamic lands in 1948, right? In Christian lands, it was outlawed by a Takana of Rabbeinu Gershom in the year 1000 or so, and that's because in Christian lands, polygamy was already forbidden. But in Arab lands, Jews had multiple wives. In Yemen, I mean, there were Jews who came to Israel with multiple wives, and the Israeli government's decision was that they weren't going to break up that family, but nobody, once they came to Israel, could have multiple wives, so.
So what Sarah is saying here is about laughter, that God brought me laughter.
Right.
And when you think of laughter in its multiple meanings, it can either be a sadomasochistic who's on top and who's playing with and who's abusing the other or killing or shooting arrows, or who can finally laugh with me. It's all about relationship.
Could be.
Sarah's relationship with God, we're not mentioning here, but I think it's very deep in that line six. God brought me laughter. Everybody hears the laughter with me. So she's finally at peace with being laughed with.
Yeah, if Yitzchak Li means laughed with me. Yitzchak Li could mean either one. Right, could mean for me, could mean with me, could mean at me. Yitzchak Li doesn't have, it's not definite. That's just, with me is a gentle translation of it. I don't know if all of you have with me in your...
On account of me.
See, so it depends how you view it. Okay, Sarah, let me go ahead. Sarah saw the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had born to Abraham playing, and we spent the first half hour talking about the meaning of playing, so I'm not going to go back over that. She said to Abraham, cast out that slave woman and her son. Notice now how she clearly, ha'ama hazot, right, that serving woman. She doesn't use her name. She refers to her by her debased position so that Abraham will know who she's talking about. For the son of that slave, he lo yirash ben ama hazot, shall not inherit, shall not share in the inheritance, im bini, with my son, im Yitzchak, with Isaac. Okay? And that's it. She doesn't say my son Isaac. She says im bini, im Yitzchak, with my son, with Isaac. And this is where translation is always inadequate. That's a very powerful statement that Sarah makes. She twice emphasizes Hagar's position, and I mean once in relation to Yishmael, and twice emphasizes Isaac's position in relation to herself. And also Isaac, which I guess is the way of saying your son too. Im bini im Yitzchak. She doesn't want to say your son. She doesn't want to use those words because it will remind Abraham that Yishmael is also his son. And, you know, this is a very cleverly crafted piece of rhetoric here. But Yitzchak is safe to use. So the issue here, you can, and again, it's impossible to know. The issue may be inheritance, because inheritance is clearly always going to be a very difficult issue. The issue may just be jealousy and rivalry. or both. She doesn't say, because I don't like the way she's treating me. That was her claim the first time. This time, it's about, I don't want him to think that he's going to get, you know, the family property. And again, Abraham's reaction is very upset. Vayera hadavar, yera comes from the word ra. It was very bad in Abraham's eyes, right? That is, you know, it was, he kicked them out once, he brought them back. The idea now that he has a son, he has to lose his other son, is very painful for him. And Isaac, and Abraham and Sarah's interests here, as has happened, by the way, now several times, their interests are not the same. They're not identical, right? His interest is, you know, all big, one big happy family and break, keep all his kids together. Her interest is not that. And it may be, remember the last two times, whose interest prevailed? Abraham's. Sarah said, I'm your sister, I'm not your wife. That happened twice. So maybe he feels like he owes her. Al odot beno. And here's the what I think is really interesting. Odot means the events of. Abraham was greatly distressed on the events of his son. Which son? Yishmael is the logical conclusion. I just think it's interesting that it doesn't say Yishmael. It says the facts of his son. Maybe he's concerned about Isaac having this mother. Maybe he's concerned about Isaac losing Yishmael. Maybe Isaac is his first choice, but he doesn't want Isaac to lose Yishmael, who after all is an older brother. And now Yishmael's old enough to take care of himself, but how's Isaac going to feel growing up knowing that as soon as he was born, he lost the older brother because he was born? Right. I mean, obviously, Yishmael's the obvious one that they're talking about, but I think the Bible is intending to raise other possibilities by using deliberately ambiguous language. Otherwise, it would just say on the facts of Yishmael. Right? The legal position of Yishmael is quite clear. Let me read you from Sarna. Sarah had undertaken to recognize her own as the male offspring of the union with Abraham and Hagar. Remember that? She gave Yishmael legal rights because she said, here, he's going to be like my son. A match she herself initiated and imposed on her husband. Abraham, for his part, undoubtedly recognized Yishmael as his legitimate son, a fact repeatedly attested to in a variety of earlier texts, chapter 16, chapter 17, anyway, and affirmed here. Did this status assure Yishmael automatic rights even after the birth of Isaac? Sarah's formulation of her demand and the extreme length to which she was prepared to go point to an affirmative answer. In other words, it seems like, given how upset Sarah is, that Yishmael, in fact, would inherit because he was Abraham's legitimate son. And remember, Abraham said to God, remember when Abraham says to God, if only you would take Yishmael? Right? So obviously, Yishmael had a lot of status. The laws of Hammurabi, these are laws that predate the Bible, and the still earlier Lipit Ishtar. Paragraph 25, by the way, in case you're perusing the laws of Lipit Ishtar. Make inheritance a legal consequence of the father's acceptance of the infant as his legitimate son. Once you accept that kid, according to earlier texts in the Bible, as your legitimate son, and remember the Bible grew up in a world, it wasn't as though it grew up in a vacuum, then the kid's legitimate. There's no doubt Yishmael was entitled to a share of Abraham's estate. The key to Sarah's demand lies in the clause of Lipit Ishtar, where it is stipulated that a father can grant freedom to a slave woman and the children she has borne him, in which case they forfeit their share of the paternal property of the king. Okay, so if you have a slave and you've adopted that kid, he has a right to your property, but if you emancipate him and send him away, he forfeits all rights. Which makes perfect sense to what's going on here. So Sarah's saying, you know, set them free. Give them their freedom. So let me just, let's just finish off this section because I don't want to leave Abraham hanging here. God says to Abraham, Al yerah be'enecha, don't let it be bad in your eyes, because it's exact. That's an exact reversal of what the previous verse said. The first said, Vayerah hadavar me'od be'enei. It was very bad in the eyes of Abraham, and this one says, Al yerah be'enecha, don't let it be bad in your eyes. Okay, God's saying your reaction doesn't have to be that way. Al hana'ar v'al amatecha, for the boy and for his mother. Kol asher tamar elecha Sarah, everything Sarah says to you, shma bikola, listen to her voice. Okay? Everything she tells you to do, do it. Dishes, everything. So I know this has almost a comedy routine, but I think someone told me that Bill Cosby used to say this, but the story has gone around for years that to many newlyweds, Shaul Lieberman, who was the greatest Talmudist, maybe in the 20th century in terms of the scope of his knowledge, when his students used to get married, he used to say, and as far as he was concerned, you know, basically, boys were born to study their whole lives. That's what they should be doing. I mean, that was his, you know, everything else was a bitul Torah. Bitul Torah means a waste of the time that you should spend studying Torah. And he used to tell newlywed guys that the first night that they're married, they should volunteer to dry the dishes and drop them. Said, and then you will never have to do it again. I don't know if it worked. Anyway, unfortunately, my wife knows the story, so... Shema b'kola, everything says, listen to her voice, because through Isaac, you will be called Zera, offspring, literally. In other words, Isaac is going to be the continuation of your line. So don't worry about it. It's not going to be Abraham, it's going to be Isaac. It's not going to be Ishmael, it's going to be Isaac. And also, the slave woman, I will make her a great nation, for he too is your seed.
The son of the slave.
It's for the son of the slave woman, right. I'll make her a great nation, for he too is your seed. So the idea here is, first of all, that God takes away Abraham's guilt. Right? We can have our own moral judgments about it, but if, in fact, God says this to Abraham, then Abraham is guiltless because God's telling him to do it. And God's also promising a reward through Ishmael that he'll also be a great nation. So Abraham will be a great nation not only through Isaac, but also through Ishmael, although the connection to Ishmael will be tenuous through the rest of the... I mean, the Ishmaelites are mentioned in several different contexts, but nothing powerful. And the connection of Ishmael to Islam doesn't exist until the founding of Islam, right? That when it is asserted that they're the continuation of the Ishmaelites. But, yeah.
It looks to me that it was God's decision for Hagar and Ishmael to leave, because when you're married, you know, you say things to each other and the spouse feels guilty and comes back and says, you know what, I feel guilty about what you said.
Right.
Or throughout marriage, it's not like the wife says something and this is it.
Right.
Or the husband something and that's it. So she says something. He felt bad about it, but it seems to me that God ultimately, he made the decision. He said, you know what? Go ahead and do it.
Right.
So it's a little bit...
So again, it's like you can play the game that we played with the first time with Hagar and Sarah and Abraham and try to decide who's the real catalyst here. Who forces this to come to be. And ultimately, it looks like God. God is the one, after all, who enables them to have a child when they wouldn't be able to have a child, and who reinforces, and God presumably would foresee what Sarah's reaction is going to be. We could foresee it, so I guess God could. And then says, no, you should, in fact, follow what it is that Sarah says and send the kid out of the house. And it is... it certainly is true that we have seen how difficult it is to create any kind of, to start any kind of movement, which is what God's doing, after all, with a divided loyalty. And if Yishmael's not the right person to do it, then Yishmael has to be elsewhere while God does it through Isaac. But it's cruel. I mean, it's hard. Let me put it that way. I don't know if it's cruel. It's hard.
A better advice would have been, let Yishmael stay and give him some of your inheritance.
Right.
And Yitzchak will still be yours.
Yes.
So, you know, it's...
But it could have. It could have been. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you could understand why Sarah, waiting for 100 years, wants to make sure that this, you know, yeah.
Do you know how Islam understands this parable?
No, I don't. I don't. I think she said that, do I know how Islam understands this paragraph? My guess is it doesn't have this paragraph. Remember, Islam does not feel any necessity of explaining the parts of the Hebrew Bible that don't accord with the Quran. It only explains the story in the Quran, and I'm sure that this part reads differently in the Quran. So we'd have to take a look at what the Quran says to see what Islam would say. In the same way that Christians are always asking me, how does Judaism explain this part or that part of the New Testament? And I said, we don't. It doesn't, you know, it's not our story, basically. We don't feel the necessity to explain it theologically. We might have historical guesses. But any more than I have a need to explain the Bhagavad Gita or any other sacred scripture. I don't need to explain Indian sacred scripture. I don't need to explain Christian sacred scripture. They're all the same to me. Historically, it might be interesting because it sheds light on what was going on in Israel at the time. That's why the New Testament has some relevance. But as a theology, it doesn't have any relevance to me.
Right. Yeah. Which other holy books have you read?
Have I read? I've read the New Testament. And I've read sections of the Quran and sections of the Bhagavad Gita, but that's it. And I've read a little bit, although it's not a sacred text, of Confucius, which is a really interesting, you know, Confucianism is very like Judaism in a lot of ways. It's not exactly, except it's not exactly a religion, but it is a religion. It became a social system for thousands of years in China, and people saw it as almost divine in its wisdom, and they regulated their lives by it. But anyway, so it's that. No, I never read Dianetics. I don't like science fiction. It's true. That's what it is. It's science fiction. It was written by a science fiction writer. And if you go far enough in the beliefs of Dianetics, it has, you know, these. It's all about aliens who are living on other planets. It's science fiction. So, and although I have read some of the classics of science fiction, I never really like science fiction nearly as much. I'd much prefer to read a good mystery. Yeah.
Well, I'm just curious, do the rabbis ever talk about the God character?
All the time.
Okay.
All the time.
Because in business, I mean, like what you said makes sense. You know, like you know, you need something to go a certain way, someone
right.
might need to go a different way. And
yes.
I made this decision, the rabbis might say, or you know, you might say, well, no, that's not ethical, it's cruel. Like
right.
You said it's cruel.
Right.
So, just, you know, is it okay that God...
Yes. God, well, yes, they don't think of it as being cruel. They think of it as I mean, you can always take refuge in God knowing things that we don't know.
Right.
And how many times have you made decisions and said, you know, if I know now what if I knew then what I know now, so it may be that God knows. I mean, what the rabbis assume is that Ishmael's character, that's the whole shooting people with arrows thing. Ishmael's character was such that he couldn't coexist with Isaac. God knew that. So God said, don't worry, get rid of him. He'll make his own nation. He can't actually be around while Isaac is forming his nation.
So he saw ahead.
You would, right. Then you would know. But that's, you know, that is one of the ways that the rabbis explain God's decision, is that God knew the future and therefore had to decide this way or that way sometimes. But they don't always use that, because when the rabbis ask, why didn't you let Yishmael die of thirst in the wilderness because he was going to raise up a people who would plague the Jews. The answer is that you judge people where they are, not where they will one day be. So,
yeah.
It is a contradiction. 1, 2, and then we're done. Yeah.
I started empathizing with Abraham with the attachment over 12, 13 years with
okay.
Ishmael, how hard it must have been
right.
to break that bond. And then I moved on into how this is kind of a prelude to his numbness about taking Isaac to sacrifice.
Maybe so. When we get to the story, we'll talk about it. Perhaps so, but I just want to, I don't want to jump ahead to that story because that we're going to do probably for many, many sessions. Yeah.
Ishmael doesn't disappear here. He comes back. He's they bury, the brothers bury their
right.
brother
yes.
together.
Yes, they do.
There's been a midrash that one of the people that accompany the Akedah was Ishmael. But
right.
Abraham has a relationship.
Right. Yeah, you shouldn't make the assumption that it means that Abraham never spoke to Ishmael again. And in fact, apart from the Midrash, it is true that later on in the Bible, the two of them come back together to bury Abraham, which also suggests that Isaac and Ishmael were probably okay with each other. I mean, look, Isaac, what did Isaac do? He was born, you know?
I think